hello there. Welcome to yet another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong, and in this podcast, I speak to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, or Acast. Like the Facebook page or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk, and check out show notes and other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. You can directly support this podcast by taking advantage of a special offer for Turkey Book Talk listeners, courtesy of Hearst Publishers. In that deal, you can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any one of five great books published by Hearst. Check it out via the address hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. That's hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Purchasing through that deal is cheaper than Amazon, and most importantly for me, it helps support this podcast. Titles included on the list are written by authors who have featured on previous episodes of Turkey Book Talk. They include The Circassian, A Life of Eshref Bey, Late Ottoman Insurgent and Special Agent by Benjamin Fortner, The New Turkey and Its Discontent by Simon Waldman and Emre Çalışkan, The Poison Well, Empire and Its Legacy in the Middle East by Roger Hardy, Out of Nowhere, The Syrian Kurds in Peace and War by Michael Gunter, and Jihad and Death, The Global Appeal of Islamic State by Olivier Roy. To order any of those titles for a third off plus free delivery, visit hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com and help support Turkey Book Talk. Another way to support, if you enjoy or benefit from this podcast, is through my Patreon account, which lets you make a small or large pledge on a per episode basis. The standard pledge is $3 per episode, but you can contribute as much or as little as you want, and you can find details of that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. But let's get on with this latest episode, in which we hear from Cenk Özbay. He's an associate professor at Sabancı University in Istanbul and the author of the book Queering Sexualities in Turkey, Gay Men, Male Prostitutes and the City, which is published by IB Taurus. In the conversation, we address the troubled state of LGBT rights in Turkey at the moment and the general trajectory of the issue over the past 15 or so years. But first of all, we talk about his research for the book, delving into the murky world of male prostitution in Turkey in the 2000s, which allowed him to explore assumptions about class, local and global culture, and masculine behaviour. I started asking Cenk Özbay to explain how his book examined the interaction between class and sexual identity in Turkey.
Well, this idea has become really stronger as I work on this subject, that gay identity in Turkey is first and foremost about class. Being a gay person, especially in the 2000s, but still, I believe, is about your class background, your class identity, your class position. So if you're open to the global trends, discourses, practices, self-presentation, bodily presentation, then you have a greater inclination towards defining yourself as gay than the working class, migrant, poor populations. So this is then an encounter between those like gay identified middle class people and those people who don't call themselves gay but into same-sex sexualities. Therefore, I was trying to understand the nature of this labeling, identification, or self-definitions, how they overlap. I came to a larger conclusion that, and this was also an article that I wrote before, is that like those rent boys who are coming from the Varoş neighborhoods, the slum neighborhoods, squatter neighborhoods, are actually investing on their authentic masculinities. And in the book, I explain this and explicate this in greater detail, what sort of authentic, unpolluted, uncontaminated, natural masculinities they have and they enact and perform. So this real manhood that they claim they have is intermingled as a marketable strategy with their performances as rent boys. Therefore, we're talking about the transformation of a regular Varoş boy into a rent boy who performs and sells sex. And in order to do that, I claim they design and stage an exaggerated form of masculinity. There are like some exaggerations, some calculated performances. As a whole, this is a particularly masculine subjectivity that these rent boys produce and perform in their encounters with gay men. Well, the point is, like, many people are really curious about this. Are rent boys really gay people who can't tell that they are gay, or they're just pretending? And this is, in this question, this exaggerated sense of exaggerated masculinity plays a significant role. After like more than a decade observation, I'm able to tell that like some rent boys internalized the identity or made a peace with the identity and come out as gay men. Therefore, like the exaggerated nature of their masculinities evolve And some, though, don't take up the gay identity position and they turn back to their real lives. And the exaggerated masculinity they did became a part of their own lives.
The research is really quite vivid in the book. There's a lot of transcripts that you provide, and you interviewed a lot of people involved in buying sex and selling it. I just wonder, like, this is obviously like a sensitive subject. How difficult was it to really get people to open up about what they were doing?
It was like, as I talk about in the book a lot, well, Turkey has this like sex negative culture, I would say. It's not good to talk about sexuality, especially in the last period that we are experiencing in here in this country. But even before, like, I started this research before AKP became so powerful and dominant in reshaping popular culture and the boundaries of, like, what's talkable and what's not talkable in public. But still, like, let's say always, homosexuality has been a taboo, social taboo, that you're not supposed to do or think or talk about it. And under this taboo of forbidden sexuality, let's say, male prostitution is even a more clandestine topic. So even though people have an imagination and a language to talk about, even curse homosexuality, they don't really know how to talk about, or they don't really know how to think about male prostitution. So it was kind of really, really difficult in the sense that to claim that there is such a thing, such an illicit organization in Istanbul, and it's not a really small group. I'm not talking about 10 people, 20 people, but hundreds of people are involved. And then, of course, the second difficulty, the real difficulty, was to convince those people to talk to me about those issues that they hate to talk about. They try not to talk about. I developed certain strategies, certain sociological, methodological approaches that we use in our other research as well. I think I have an advantage that I am a graduate of a high school, a vocational high school, in one of those slum areas in Gebze, Istanbul, at the outskirts of Istanbul, actually. And I think I somehow knew how to talk with these guys without disturbing them or without irritating them. I always think that this was one of the, like, implicit advantages that I have in my contacts with them. But of course, it doesn't always work. Like, many people didn't talk to me, many rent boys. And even some gay men didn't talk to me about their involvement in the male sex work. But at the end, I was able to gather information and observe and talk to them and listen to them. But of course, it was always difficult. Many times interviews didn't work. Sometime they didn't show up. It was really difficult to catch them outside gay bars, like regular times, weekdays, for example, in daytime. But somehow it worked. I think total interviews are about like 32 rent boys and customers, gay customers. But with informant interlocutors, it's way more than that.
I mean, you mentioned there about the Varosh kind of peripheral urban kind of slum neighborhoods, or very kind of working class neighborhoods at least. And you talk in the book about how this is kind of closely associated, of course, with like more masculine codes. And that's kind of contrasted, as you describe it, with the kind of more middle class or upper class lifestyle of people who would more confidently describe themselves as gay. Could you just talk a bit about this dichotomy between like the urban periphery and masculine behavior and the kind of more upper class, confidently kind of urbanized gay lifestyle?
Well, I gave a lot of references in the book to other male sex work scholarly research. And if you look at globally, we can find that the fetishization of young working class masculinities amongst gay men is almost a universal issue. It's virtually everywhere. So Istanbul is not independent in that sense. One point here is obviously class. The refined, cultured, middle class, global, who can speak in English, who can understand English, gay men on the one hand, and local, migrant, working class, young men on the outskirts. This is the number one duality. And then there is also another duality, and this is about age. So the young, working class men, the rent boys, are, let's say, from 16 to 25, mid-20s, I guess. However, always the customers are way older than this, like at least starting with like at the age of 40. So therefore, like this is kind of the old, as you say, confidently gay in terms of gender performance, more queer gay men, refined, educated middle class, and then the young working class masculinities they desire and the kind of like sexual commodity those young boys provide.
Çile bülbülüm, çile, çile bülbülüm, çile, çile bülbülüm. Çile
I guess you addressed it a bit at the start, but this research was carried out a long time ago, and mainly it was in the kind of analog world of gay bars. And now, first of all, a lot of those gay bars that you talk about in the book have closed down. But more generally, like things have really changed with smartphones and whatnot, and it's really shifted the landscape. Just talk about this aspect and how it's kind of reshaped the LGBT experience in Turkey's biggest cities.
Well, like in the book, I talk about Biento. This is a closed bar right now. It was a rent boy bar exclusively. So only rent boys and their customers would go there, and me, obviously. This is not there anymore. So this is the biggest shift, biggest change since then. But for example, Sengel, in the book, I talk about Sengel. This is also not the real name I'm giving you. It's still open, and it is the gay bar in Istanbul because like it encompasses a diverse clientele. Like everybody goes there. Some love it, some doesn't love it, but they go there. And there are a number of bars, other bars that rent boys visited, frequented, used in different times. Well, queer nightlife in Istanbul has been shrinked recently, obviously, like especially after 2010. In Istanbul, we used to have larger gay bars, gay clubs, some open air, diverse class backgrounds, like different bars for different classes. So right now, the options are obviously more limited. There are only one or two large clubs that many people would go regularly. I'm not quite sure about the reasons. I don't know if it's an internal dynamic that gays and queer people are not enough for these bars, or there's a political pressure or police pressure that is more difficult to open and manage a gay bar, queer bar right now. I'm not quite sure about this. But the social reality that we look at is that queer nightlife has changed a lot, and in a negative way. Like the options are less right now, and the available spaces are lesser also. And beyond that, I think one more important point, sex has been deterritorialized. So queers or men who are into same-sex sexualities, they had to find a space to engage in sexuality, a bar or a Turkish hammam. There were certain hammams that used by gay men for meeting or to have sex in Istanbul. I even visited some of them in 2000s, and that they are closed too. Police, I know that the police doesn't allow a gay hammam right now. So what do they have right now is, on the other hand, of course, the mobile phone applications. First, the websites. It started with the websites that everybody was online. Everybody was looking for possible sex dates or romantic dates on websites, certain websites. And later, in the last couple of years, obviously, everybody is looking at their phones. So we also need to consider, like, when we look at the queer nightlife, we also need to look at how both queer sociabilities and sexualities got deterritorialized, became independent of space, and became virtual, if it's proper to say that.
It's funny. I mean, I guess there's been stories about in London as well, like a lot of famous gay bars have closed down, and there's been this kind of sense that people have been asking the question, you know, are they a thing of the past? And, you know, a lot of people have been saying, you know, oh, it's because of technology, you know, it's really changed the landscape. The way that people think about, you know, socializing has completely changed. And, you know, you don't need to go to a gay bar anymore to meet people. It's much more kind of individualized. Obviously, in Istanbul, though, there's a difference because there has been a kind of rise in this sense of, you know, political pressure, or at least there's more of a political focus and more political condemnation. Yes. These days, and that probably also has an effect on public displays.
Exactly. Like, I remember my interviewees and gay people that I talked to, they were always mentioning how they were shocked that AKP didn't directly intervene gay lifestyles, gay bars, gay cafes until very recently. Let's say before 2013, there was an open gay cafe, many gay bars, and most importantly, of course, the government let people to have the march, the pride parade. After 2013, something has changed. That's why I can't be quite sure, because as you talk about London and other parts of the world, like, everything is changing regarding queer sociabilities and sexualities in Turkey as well, but I can't be sure if this is because of the political intervention or imposition, or it's internal dynamics of technology and of changing individualities.
But there certainly has been this spike in pressure, really. You know, every year, really, around the time of the Pride Week, as you mentioned, at the end of June, there is this kind of spike in tensions. There's more kind of media attention and media condemnation, really, from the kind of conservative press. And it's become a kind of sad tradition because, you know, for, I think, 15 years straight, it was, you know, always held in the middle of Istanbul. And it became particularly, I remember, in 2012, 2013, it was a huge, huge event, the Pride March. And now it's just routinely a site of a kind of police lockdown and eventually tear gas and a big crackdown. And I don't know, could you just kind of reflect a bit on this sad new tradition?
Well, I don't know, like, it's really not good, obviously, for queer population. But on the other hand, like, I have different views about the Pride Parade. I am a supporter. I always go whenever it is allowed and whenever we can go, obviously, not in the last 3 years. But I know many people who doesn't support and who doesn't walk, who doesn't show up. So I'm not quite sure. I was like looking for other ways to express the political energy or the social reaction against heteronormativity and against homophobia. Well, it was the most legitimate and most visible answer, obviously, to those like suppressing dynamics in Turkish society. But I think queer people in Turkey should be more kind of like insistent in finding other ways. If the government is so rigid, and if it doesn't let people walk the Pride Parade, maybe they should look at somewhere else to walk. Maybe they should think of an alternative activity, an alternative meeting. I don't really know. Because, you know, we got locked, right, for last 3 years. Some people go there, wait for the police reaction, and the police doesn't let us walk. So obviously it can't be solved this way. We need to imagine some other ways and then develop strategies to find other outlets to express our political anger or our reaction or our visibility, I guess.
For example, what kind of alternatives would you think?
I don't know, like, last week, for example, maybe you have heard of it. Some graduate students of mine from Boğaziçi University and Sabancı University and other colleges organized queer sports event called Queer Olympics, I guess. And this was really creative in the sense that, like, they were cooperating with Kadıköy municipality and the islands municipality, Adalar municipalities. So they kind of hired some public spaces, sports places and parks. And therefore, like, they performed these three-day events, like beach volleyball, swimming, cycling, walking around. So I think this was a really creative alternative solution. Like, of course, it's not Pride Parade, what they did, obviously. But I think it was a relevant strategy to find alternatives, find other outlets to show themselves and call other queers and non-queers alike together and be in space. Or there might be other ways, like other festivals or like renting private spaces maybe, although I know that this is against the nature of Pride Parade. But if the government is insistent on this, I don't know, there's no good to walk on the same way again. But of course, these are my personal ideas. I don't know if you're interested in these, William.
No, it's very interesting. I mean, I think there's something in that, because you could also compare it with, you know, the May the 1st parade every year at May the 1st, Labor Day. Mm-hmm. It's just become a very depressing kind of just repeat performance where you just have people kind of determined to go to Taksim, and you just know exactly what's going to happen. The police are just going to crack down on them. People are going to get arrested. Everybody's going to be unhappy about what's happening. And exactly. There seems to be no kind of creative thinking outside the box. You know, people maybe should be, it's not really accepting defeat at the hands of the police, but it's, you know, just trying to think of a different strategy.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That was I meant it.
Yıldızlara baktırdım, falları da çıkmıyorsun. Seni görmem imkansız, imkansız, imkansız. Rüyalarım olmazsa. Pencereden bakmıyor, yollara çıkmıyorsun. Seni görmem imkansız, imkansız, imkansız. Rüyalarım olmazsa. Pencereden bakmıyor, yollara çıkmıyorsun.
I have a kind of theory about this, like this pressure that's kind of built or become visible in the last few years, and particularly with reference to the Pride March, really, because it was allowed to go ahead under the AKP for many years, and people were always surprised, you know, this is a very kind of strange, paradoxical thing where you've got a religious conservative government that allows an LGBT rights march to go ahead every year. But I wonder, at the time, it was because it was just once a year and it was like not seen as kind of threatening, or it wasn't seen as representing a bigger movement. It didn't seem like a kind of threat, and it wasn't really a risk. It was more kind of like a curiosity for wider society. And, you know, it happened once a year and then everyone forgot about it. But now, in the last few years, obviously the issue has become much more visible. There's a lot more activism. And in a way, and not just in Turkey, I mean, globally, people are aware of this. And it's kind of prompted a backlash, really. And, mm-hmm. and we've seen that backlash in recent years in Turkey. And so on the one hand, there's a sense where there's been this kind of grassroots progress where the issue is far more visible, but on the official level, you know, they've seen that progress and they're seeing it as a kind of danger. You know, it's become a kind of moral crisis as they see it. I mean, what do you make of that?
I think I started the book, or in the first pages of the book, I talk about how I like participated a Lambda meeting in Istanbul in 1998, and it was hidden. This was, of course, pre-internet. It was hidden. They didn't have a space, so they were renting a room, a commercial room, to meet. So in 20 years, it became way more institutionalized, publicly known, more active, as you said, visible in many levels. My colleague Ayfer Bartucan'dan from Boğaziçi University and I have completed a new research about like gender and sexual activist students in different cities of Turkey. And there we listened many stories from Ankara, İzmir, Antalya, Eskişehir and Istanbul, and saw that not only in terms of like LGBTQ or queer activism and communities, but even the gender activists, feminists, like namely, are under great pressure right now in the last couple of years. So I don't want to like try to like reach a macro conclusion about political structure in Turkey out of this. But what we have listened and witnessed is that somehow it's really, really difficult to be an activist of rights in Turkey right now. I'm sure you're familiar with those like human rights activists that are imprisoned right now. What we found in our research that, like, in many universities in all those cities, the university administrations forbid feminist and queer students to get publicized or to get visible, to engage in activities in the campus space, to meet or to arrange activities. So I'm a little bit like more pessimistic. Like, I don't think this is only about queer activism. And I don't think that the government perceives this as a threat to itself. I think the scene is way more bigger than this. Like, activism of rights, human rights, let's say, or other sorts of non-governmental activism is under risk in Turkey right now, in the, like, most optimistic phrase that I would use right now.
And you work as an associate professor at Sabancı University, which is a private university in Istanbul, and we're about to start the new, you know, academic year. And I just wonder, like, on a personal level, like, some of this research is obviously quite kind of sensitive stuff, and particularly, as you mentioned, that with the current official atmosphere and the tendency towards kind of religious conservatism. I mean, on a personal level, personal professional level, have you felt any particular kind of restrictions on your work or...?
No, I haven't. Like, I guess I'm on the, like, lucky side, thanks to, like, I guess, like, environment that I've been in. Before, I was working at Boğaziçi University, and since last year I'm at Sabancı, and I have always worked on sexualities and masculinities. It's like my professional identity, and I never encountered any negative comment or restriction kind of thing. And research, like, we just completed with Ayfer Bartu Candan, was supported by both, like, Boğaziçi and Sabancı Universities, as well as Open Society Foundation. So I think that's what we need to do. We need to keep researching about these subjects that we believe it's better for a democratic society, equal society, open society, diverse society. But as an answer to your question, on the personal level, I haven't encountered any difficulties.
And also, just finally, like, more generally, I mean, one of the things that everybody knows, of course, at the moment is that there's this big pressure on academia in Turkey. And there's a kind of saddening move among many academics to kind of apply to move for positions abroad, outside the country. And there's been kind of all kinds of reports and also anecdotal evidence that, you know, people are saying, you know, there's been a big rise in applications to find work elsewhere. Could you just kind of reflect on this general atmosphere? How has it been at Sabancı, for example? And
well, of course, like, it is tremendously sad to, like, see what's going on with my, like, colleagues that are, like, fired from universities. It's not acceptable. Like, I wouldn't want any of my colleagues, any professors fired because of what they think, what they do, what they say, or any other kind of thing. Like, this is probably democracy 101, I guess. Today, I was talking with a former professor of mine. He's a retired sociology professor. And he was talking about, like, his memories, his experiences after the September 12th military coup in Turkey, the undemocratic 1980, exactly. I'm sorry, the undemocratic years between 1980, like, afterwards, actually, because, like, the higher education institution in Turkey was established in 1982. And afterwards, there was also an exodus from university back then, too. Like, some people were fired, some people resigned and left the university and even the country. And I was trying to understand, like, how, what to do to resist, what to do to protect the university, what to do to better in the future. So, of course, like, we are not optimistic, to be honest, right now. We need to do our job, help our jobless colleagues, and to do more research in collaboration with them. Just like to live in the academic framework, shouldn't leave the academic life in Turkey. That's like my personal belief and my persuasion.
That was Cenk Özbay. Many thanks to him for taking the time to speak. If you're interested, I've put a link up at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com of an article written by me and published a couple of years ago about the deteriorating environment for LGBT activists in Turkey. By the way, the first music clip that we heard was Chile Bülbül, performed by the great transgender diva Bülent Ersoy, and the second was İmkan Söz, sung by the perhaps even greater Zeki Müren. Don't forget, Turkey Book Talk listeners can support the podcast and get a 33% discount plus free delivery by purchasing any one of 5 books from Hearst Publishers as part of a special offer. To check out the books available, visit the special page created for the deal, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Another way to support the podcast is via my Patreon account, making a small or large pledge on a per episode basis. Many thanks to my current Patreon supporters, Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Michelle Zimmer, Jean-Marcus Vomo, Steve Bryant, Aaron Atterman, Max Hoffman, Andrew McDowell, and Paul Levin. Also remember to rate or review Turkey Book Talk on whatever platform you listen on, which really does help increase awareness of it for other potential listeners. Follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay updated with new episodes, and email recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until our next episode in a couple of weeks, farewell and thank you very much for listening.